Accession number 18266, Reel 3.
Mrs. Beasley, Reel 3.
A soldier appeared in the door, and there were two girls working on a long table. They were probably threading cords or something or other, and they were just out of sight of the man in the door, and I saw one of the girls recognize the man and seize the girl she was working with and pushed her violently underneath the table. Now, under the table, there were great big red bags full of parachutes which were waiting to be dealt with. And they pushed her in there and hid her behind the bags. And the soldier came storming into the room, demanding to see his wife. He had come home on leave unexpectedly, and he'd heard that she'd been playing around with another man. And he'd come down to find her and sort it out. And it was really a terrible scene because her friends realized what was happening. There probably was truth in the rumor anyway. And they were so frightened that he was going to assault her in some way that's why they pushed her down under the table and hid her out of sight. It was an extraordinary vivid memory and one surrounded by unhappiness and the misery of this poor man who'd come back from fighting the war to find out what had happened, or what the rumours, the local stories said about his wife, who was a very pretty girl. But the others said, oh no, she wasn't there that day, she hadn't come in, she must have been sick, and that he'd better go. And finally, although he was a very, very angry man, I don't think he believed them, he nevertheless finally left. And one of the inspectors on the floor inspector ushered him out and took him away, and then they pulled the girl out. But it was a very sad little happening, as it were. I remember that quite vividly. But I was telling you about this cutting of the webbing. You know, if you're having to do a job that is quite so boring as that, you spend the first quarter of an hour thinking, oh dear, this is boring, and then you spend the next half an hour thinking, I wonder how many I can do in 5 minutes, and then after that you wonder if you're doing them properly, and then after about 2 hours you realise the appalling truth that you are going to go on doing this automated thing for the whole of the day until the end of the day, and with absolutely nothing else except just working your arms like a machine. It is quite soul-destroying. And when people talk to me now about the nobility of work in factories, I understand an awful lot more than I would have done if I hadn't been through it myself. I know exactly what it's like, and it is quite soul-destroying. But I worked on the webbing for about 3 months, I suppose, and then after that I was threading the cords into parachutes. And then I worked with a...
How do you do that?
Girl. Well, you have to have a long bodkin thing, very long bodkin. It must have been about 3 foot long, I suppose, four foot long, I should think. Yes, probably 4 foot long. And you threaded the end of the parachute cord, which of course was white nylon, through the end of the bodkin, and you ran it up through the channel that I was telling you about between the panels, out of the top, took it out of the bodkin, pulled the cord through. All the cords were marked, and so that you knew how far up you had to pull it. Then you threaded the bodkin up the proper channel the other side, and then you pull the cord down that side. But it was a funny job, because for this one was standing up, and the parachutes were laid on a long table, and you ran up and down them, threading your bodkin up and pulling up the cords, and then you ran back the other way, pulling them down the other way. So instead of sitting down all day, I was standing all day, from 8 in the morning till 6 at night. And we worked in pairs. I worked with another girl who's language was interesting. But she and I were good friends. She did, beautifully. And when I finally objected to the number of times she used to say everything was bloody, she said, well, what's wrong with that? Bloody's in the Bible, which was something I couldn't really disagree with. But anyhow, she and I got on very well together. But it was rather nice working with somebody else for a change instead of working by oneself. And I think about that time, I'm sure it was then that the V1 started, because occasionally then, when they first started, it was thought that there were raids, and so the sirens used to go. And at that point, everybody was encouraged to leave the shop floor, the work floor, and to go down to the big cellars, which of course were underneath heels. But I must admit, I didn't like it down there, and I only went down once and then didn't go again. And if one heard a doodle bug, as they were called in those days, coming close, we all used to dive under the tables amongst the red bags that I told you about. But not very many people went down into the cellars then. It was a gloomy place. The first night of the doodlebugs, nobody knew what they were, and it was a Saturday night, and this ACAC battery started up quite early on, and and I watched the little planes coming across the sky with this friend who I shared the lodgings with, because she and I were both volunteered to be fire guards, and so because the sirens had gone, we thought that we probably ought to go out and man our particular posts. But the ACAC guns went on all night so that we couldn't sleep at all, because they didn't know they weren't proper planes. They didn't realize what they were then. And we were so exhausted in the morning with no sleep. And for the previous year, 8 months, I suppose, every Sunday we had been to the guards' chapel to church every Sunday. But because we hadn't slept that night and were so tired, we thought that we would go down into the country, just locally, somewhere down in Surrey, and climb up on a common there and sleep in the sun. And we got on a bus and went up to Westminster Bridge, and when we were stopped at a bus stop there, and there was the most almighty bang of one of these B1s going off, and that was the one that destroyed the guards' chapel. So that was an extraordinarily fortunate that we weren't there, because nearly everybody was killed. I think it took everybody some time to get. I don't think people ever got used to them, because they were very frightening. Because I think you could hear the engine cut out, and then everybody was waiting for where it would fall. I was not long after that. At lunchtime, we had this 3/4 of an hour. And I decided to go down to leave heels and go down to Oxford Street to buy a pair of shoes. And I waited outside at the bus stop, and the bus didn't come. And I must have waited about 6 minutes, and I thought, oh, I shall never get down there if it's any later. So I better run down to Oxford Street. So I took to my heels and ran to get down to this shop. And as I turned the corner into Oxford Street, there was the most appalling blast from a bomb, and I was blown into a shop window. But I went on and got the shoes, and when I came back, the bus stop where I had been waiting was just a great big hole. And of course, the three people who I'd been waiting with must have all been blown up just like that. It's quite extraordinary how one just missed things, and how close death came to everybody, really, in those days.
What about the V2s?
V2s were absolutely frightful, but at least you didn't have any fear before they came. Either you were blown up or you weren't blown up, and you didn't have the suspense. So I think on the whole they were less frightening. It sounds funny really, but I think they were less frightening than the V1s, I think.
When you had the eye symptoms, what exactly were they?
I don't know. I was just told they were acute eye strain. From looking at this very bright silk, bright white, under this poor lighting, I suppose that's what caused it.
But they were you having pain? Or?
Oh, terrible pain, yes. Awful pain in my eyes, both eyes. Couldn't believe it, really, when it first started. I kept on thinking I must be imagining it. I thought my eyes were tired and all the rest of it. And by the time I went to see the eye man, he was really quite annoyed with me. He said I'd left it far too long. But when I went home, I was sent back to Cornwall for these 2 months, and I wasn't allowed to read at all for 6 weeks. And then I had to wear dark glasses. And then I was only allowed to read if I wore heavily tinted glasses. It was an extraordinary time. Not being able to read at all for a month or six weeks is very odd. You don't realise until you can't do it how much you depend upon books. I was lucky. They weren't seriously damaged forever, I think.
That period of rest, did you go?
I think so, yes. My eyes got better. Had to wear glasses after that and have had to ever since. But it was amazing to go back to Cornwall after London. So quiet.
What was this trade union you were?
Well, I didn't know what it was because I didn't really pay any attention. But there was some sort of a union amongst the girls. I joined two things. I joined whatever it was, and I really can't remember. It was some sort of a union. And I also joined a benevolent society, which was called the Hearts of Oak. And I used to pay them so much a month. Because the one thing about working in a factory was that I was paid very well. Unbelievably well for me. I mean, I got a wage packet of about £3 or £3.10 or something a week, which was an enormous amount of money. In fact, the first wage packet I got, I sent it back. I thought they must have made a mistake and said I thought they had paid me too much. Needless to say, of course, I was wrong. But I was well paid. All the factory workers were well paid. So I could pay for my lodgings and all the rest of it.
You said you were looking at bright white fabric, but were you not also looking at other colours as well?
No, I was thinking about this yesterday. The time that I was on inspection, I was only inspecting the white man-dropper fabric. I don't think that the supply droppers, the cotton, coloured cotton ones, were probably ever had the same sort of minute inspection that we had. But for man droppers, of course, it mattered enormously. I think that the khaki panels must have been inspected, but that was after I had finished working on that time. On times when there was the army was working up for the invasion of Europe, and for example, at the time of Arnhem, we made an enormous number of khaki man dropper parachutes. And after Arnhem, two of the members of the parachute regiment with their red berets came back, and we all gathered in one big room, and they told us what had happened, and thanked us for the work that we'd done in making the parachutes. It was a very nice gesture. I'm sure it was, you know, organised from on high, but in fact it was much appreciated by everybody. You really felt that these men had been through a terrible time, but that they appreciated the work that we'd done to make good man droppers, good parachutes that they used. We didn't realise then the awful disasters that had happened at Arnhem. That came later, of course. Otherwise, if you're just working in a factory and you don't see the end product actually being used, so you don't know what's happening. There was a big department, of course, for packing parachutes as well. After I finished with the threading, the parachute cords, I then went on to packing small packs. Some of the parachutes had to have little initial packs, which sprang out and then opened the main parachute pack afterwards. These were for some sort of delayed supply droppers. And I was busy packing those for some time, and that lasted right up to the end of the war. But they were all little cotton ones on little springs, and you squash them into a pack, and then they were put on the main parachute pack.
Was there a high sense of responsibility in the factory about the consequences of not doing the job properly?
Oh, yes. People work very well. They did, you know. I don't ever remember seeing a girl or a woman shirk her job or not be worried if something had gone wrong. There was an inspector of some sort of management inspector. Whether they were Irving personnel or not, I don't know. But there was somebody on each floor who used to come round and check things, and if you weren't sure about something, you could ask her to come and she would check it out for you. If you had any worries, you could always refer it up, as it were. And if any of the sewing machines went wrong, they would sort it out. And if the machine had seriously broken, there was a very small band of mechanics in brown overalls who used to come around and mend the machines. Sometimes the most extraordinary things happened with these machines. The girls would run their fingers underneath the needles, and that was awful because these machines were very big. They had huge needles. The machines that were used for stitching the parachute packs, which were lightweight canvas, were powerful. And nearly all the machines either had two needles or four needles, and they were all very big. And the girls used to occasionally get their fingers caught up and machined. And that used to be very painful for them and alarming for everybody else. One small thing, though, about the factory. There were about four or five girls who were known in those days as deaf and dumb because they had been born deaf and were therefore unable to speak coherently, at any rate. And in those days, people did a little bit of lip reading, but not very much. But these girls had been taught how to sign language, speak with their hands, and I'd learnt how to do this, and so I could communicate with them. And this was I'm sure they enjoyed it because they tended only to have their own company because nobody else in the factory could talk to them, and they used to come and talk to me because I could answer them. I was terribly slow compared with how they were lightning quick with their fingers. They could reel off a whole sentence, and they would all see who was doing it and roar with laughter because there was a joke coming at the end. They could see what was happening with their fingers. So I was very slow, but I used to like talking to them, and they used to come and talk to me. They were charming.
How had you learnt signing?
I don't know. I think I'd learnt it at school. Somebody or other had taught it to me. It's not difficult to learn. It's the practice you require in order to become efficient. It's and they, of course, were so efficient at it, they used to take shortcuts. And so instead of spelling out A-N-D, they do a little sign, and that meant and.
Did these girls who worked at the factory have ambitions, or did they just wish to be housewives?
I don't think there was any ambition there. I got to know, I should think, about seven or eight of them who I worked with really pretty well, and used to go back to their homes and have tea on a Sunday or... But we had little in common in the sense that if I had free time, I would want to go to a concert or to hear Mara Hess playing at the National Gallery, lunchtime concerts, or I would go to the Albert Hall to a promenade concert, or I would like to go and sit in the gods to go to the theatre. But the girls I worked with weren't interested in that. They were interested in going to the films, the movies, and in their own families, and in clothes. So, although we got on very well, we didn't have enough in common to do things together, not outside the factory. So I suppose, really, looking back, I was really quite lonely in London, because all my friends had... The girlfriend I shared a room with, she had joined the Wrens with no trouble at all. And all my girlfriends had joined the forces, and the other people in the big house where I lived, they had a lot of lodgers. It was a lovely house in Cheney Place, but the house had been turned into a place where people could come and live, lodging house really, and the owner, who was a very nice woman, had moved down to Sussex, and there was about six of us each who had a room there. everybody was involved in some sort of work to do with the war effort. But once the V1 started and our windows kept on being blown in, they all left except for one elderly woman and myself. And I moved my bed down into the hall because of the flying glass. And then I think I was a bit lonely because there was nobody really back at the house to talk with and do things with. And at the factory, although we were friends, we didn't do things together really outside the work. Anyway, of course, in the evenings I was extremely tired.
Was the great ambition of your work colleagues to be mothers?
I suppose so. I think to earn, to make a good living was very important. I mean, living wasn't easy in those days. And to have a job, and to have a good job, and to have a well-paid job, so that you could support yourself and do the things that you wanted, and to have the sort of clothes and the things in your house that you really cared about, were very important, and understandably so. A lot of them had children, who I suppose, really looking back, were probably evacuated. I worked for, when I was first inspecting, with a delightful person. She was very old to me. I suppose she was probably in her mid-30s, but she had children who had been evacuated because of the bombs. But and she was, as you said, a housewife. Very happy, very nice woman. But I don't think most of them had any ambition to be anything, really.
You told me off the record earlier that you were unhappy at first in this job.
Well, I was only unhappy because I think the first few weeks, well, the boredom and the monotony was pretty frightful, particularly since I'd come from working at academic subjects which I loved. And I had an inquiring mind, and it seemed very difficult to put my mind on hold while I did an extremely boring job. And I think that to start with, the first 2 or 3 weeks, it was both tiring. It was a very long day, but I think also that I found myself a very odd fish amongst the rest of the girls that I worked with. Nobody was unkind to me, but it was quite difficult to make friends because we had little in common, I suppose, really. And yet, actually, and if it was difficult for me, and I'm a very outgoing person anyway, and like people, it would have been even more difficult if I had been a shy person.
Was there really no unkindness shown towards you?
No, none at all. Nobody was unkind to me. But people would listen to how I spoke and laugh at my accent, not unkindly, but they thought the way I spoke and the things the people use these days is posh, and they thought that my accent was posh. They didn't use that word in those days. They just say, well, of course you're different, which in a way I was, but that's not easy to come to terms with, to feel that you're different, really.
They didn't have some substitute for the word posh.
I can't remember what they said. People weren't unkind to me, but I knew that they thought I was a freak.
Did you not then get interested in any aspect of the job?
The responsibility of the inspection job was a factor, which was a good factor. One felt one was doing something, but the actual monotony of doing the same thing over and over and over again is what is pretty soul-destroying. I mean, if you're actually sewing something yourself, you cut out a shirt, you sew the shirt, you make the buttonholes, you put on the buttons, you make sure that everything is aligned up, and then it is finished and you're proud of it because it is an achievement, is one thing. The actual act of cutting out a shirt and sewing it is boring in itself, but because you have achieved something of which you are pleased and up to a point proud of, that is a factor which is completely lacking in factory work. You are permanently sewing on the buttons or permanently cutting up the tail of the shirt, and you're doing nothing else, so you never see the finished article. And that is what is very difficult to come to terms with. You never finish anything. As a girl, I was very keen on sewing and cooking and all the things of a household, which I still love, making curtains and all the rest of it. But that's because you get a finished objective. But in a factory, you only get one little bit minutiae of what you're doing, and you never see the finished product. It's why when the soldiers came back, it was very worthwhile.
Was there any gain or benefit to you in having done this factory work?
Oh, I gained, because I learnt what it was like. I met an awful lot of very nice and very worthwhile people who I probably wouldn't have had the privilege to have met if I hadn't been in a factory. I learnt about their hopes and fears and aspects of life and the difficulties they had in a way I never could have done if I hadn't worked with them for so long. They were good friends of mine. I liked working with them.
What was your address in Chelsea?
Cheney Place. Number 9 Cheney Place.
Any memories of the end of the war?
Oh, marvellous memories of the end of the war. We knew it was coming, of course, like everybody else. And I'd made myself, as most of us did, we pinched a bit of off-cuts of parachute material with the red and the blue and the white, and made ourselves scarves to tie around our heads. And then, of course, the demand for parachutes dried up and there was no work to be done, so the girls were just sitting around doing nothing. I didn't want to be bored doing nothing, so I volunteered to go and work in the canteen. I thought I'd rather spread bread and butter than do nothing. So I worked in the canteen for the last month. And then the night when the country was waiting for the surrender, I was at the theatre with my mother and brother. And it was quite electric in the theatre. One knew one was waiting for peace. And after the theatre, we visited in Piccadilly. And we walked along and we put my mother on a bus because we thought she was too old to stay out any longer. And my brother and I went up to Piccadilly Circus. And so we were in the circus. Everybody was just, it was absolutely packed. And we just stood there. Everybody was waiting. And finally a sailor got up on top of a taxi and pulled up a girl after him. And then a soldier got up. And then the cheering began. And it was absolutely phenomenal. The entire place went sort of completely mad. And, you know when if one uses the word intoxicated, you only associate it really with drunkenness. But it wasn't like that night. There was an intoxication. There was nothing to do with drunkenness, and people were absolutely wild with excitement and joy and relief. And my brother and I stayed in Piccadilly Circus, and then all of a sudden the whole crowd seemed to move off down the Haymarket, and we went with the crowd and down to Trafalgar Square and right down Whitehall, right down into Downing Street. And everybody shouted for the Prime Minister, and he came out and...